Our speaker for this next hour is Ricky Jones.
I want to start off by reading a little article that Kyle Butt wrote several years ago, just kind of a prelude into our lesson. Just bear with me a minute. This is fine text. As Paul stood before King Agrippa's throne relating to the story of Christ, he declared the Messiah's life. This thing was not done in a corner. Those few words have reverberated through histories or through centuries of history as one of the hallmarks of the story of Jesus. Never was the life, death, or resurrection of Christ meant to be kept in secret, as something might be when it is stored away in a box or in an abandoned attic to be discovered later by accident, only by a fortunate few. Rather, the many facets of Christ's earthly ministry were readily available for inspection by anyone, anytime, anywhere. In fact, centuries before Christ set foot on the earth in human form, the prophets of old repeatedly had spoken of His impending arrival. Over 300 messianic prophecies filled the pages of the Old Testament. God did not try to sneak the Messiah into human affairs under cover of darkness and without warning. Truth be told, He went to considerable effort to announce to the world the news of His heralded Savior. One such instance can be found in Genesis chapter 49 and verse 10, wherein Moses wrote, "The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet, until Shiloh comes." The word Shiloh has long been recognized by biblical scholars as another name for the Messiah. This verse then explains exactly what the Messiah was to arrive when the scepter had departed from Judah. So, what is the scepter, and when did it depart from Judah? The scepter was a staff kept in possession of the elders of each of the 12 tribes of Israel and engraved with the names of the tribe. It symbolized the national sovereignty and judicial power of God's people as long as the scepter was in place. The Jews could govern themselves, excommunicate one of their own, and even administer corporal punishment, including the death penalty. Interestingly, the scepter remained in place even while the Jews were in captivity under both the Babylonians and Medes and Persians. It also remained in place for a time under Roman captivity until the emperor instituted procurators. When this occurred, even first century Jews recognized the departure of the scepter because the Romans, around AD 11, took away the Jews' right to administer capital punishment. One Jewish teacher, Rabbi Rachman, put the situation in these terms. When the members of the Sanhedrin found themselves deprived of their right over life and death, a general consternation took possession of them. They covered their heads with ashes and their bodies with sackcloth, exclaiming, "Woe unto us, for the scepter has departed from Judah, and the Messiah has not come." When the members of the Sanhedrin found that they could not put Jesus to death themselves, but had to request instead that Pontius Pilate, the Roman procurator, do so on their behalf, Luke 23, verse 24, they said, or they should have known, the Messiah was in their midst, for that was the exact prophecy Moses had recorded. The scepter had indeed departed from Judah, and the Messiah had indeed come. Yet the Jews ignored the voice of God and demanded the death sentence for His only begotten Son. Why? Because they were the people who always resisted the Holy Spirit. Acts 7, verse 51. So today in the class, as I said, this was a sermon I did some years ago, and it's an outline that I worked up, and I'm going to add to it for the class. But we're going to be talking about the crucifixion of Christ. And there's nothing more symbolic in the world. There's no icon that we can think of that outshines the cross. It doesn't matter what country you go in. They know what the cross stands for. So as far as icons go, it is probably the most recognized symbol of all. We've probably all heard sermons on the crucifixion of Christ many, many times. And just what is a crucifixion? It's believed to have originated in the Persian Empire. However, the Romans are given credit for the perfecting of it into heinous means and inflicting death. It was incredibly painful for the victim. It provided a lingering death, a horrific detent for anybody who might decide to offend the emperor. In the scriptures, we're giving some limited information about the crucifixion itself. Not a whole lot's given as far as his body and how it was tortured to the extreme, but we've given enough that we know which direction to head. But what I'm getting at, today we actually have a lot more information in the medical industry. A lot more. And that's through the providence of God. Matter of fact, if you read in Job is asked by God if he had seen the treasures of the snow or hail, and Job had no idea what those treasures were, but we know today what they are. And that's through knowledge that has increased, and through the providence of God, we can understand things. And I do believe that even our computers and the ability to retain information and post it and everyone see those things are through the providence of God. So we are blessed in this day and time having this knowledge. So we're going to kind of explore the crucifixion in the medical terms as well. But we're going to go through a timeline first leading up to this, and then we'll get more specific. If you want to read along while I'm talking in the gospel accounts, Matthew 26 and starting in verse 36, and then Mark chapter 14 and starting at verse 32, Luke 22, starting at verse 39, and then you can start with John chapter 18. And any of those accounts, as long as, well, like I said, while I'm talking, if you want to refresh your memory about the Garden of Gethsemane and the crucifixion, feel free to. Jesus is found in the Garden of Gethsemane, and that's fairly close to the Mount of Olives. He had departed from his disciples to pray to his Father. He asked in the prayer for God to remove the cup from him so that he might not have to suffer. But we know that Jesus intended all along to continue with this. This was not a indication that he was fearful of that, but he was concerned as any human would be about the crucifixion itself. Throughout his prayer and towards the end of it, before he left to go back to the disciples, we read that he was in a sweat, and there were great drops of blood falling down to the ground. This was a very, very intense time for him. Jesus had not slept at all that night, according to Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and the stress that he was in, they claimed the tiny blood vessels were rupturing in his sweat glands to cause this, as it were, red sweat drops, red blood drops that fell to the ground. That's recorded in Luke 22 and verse 44. The symptom today is known as hematohidrosis. When he returns to the disciples, we read about the betrayal by Judas. Judas is the one who brought the Roman soldiers to Christ. He kissed him for identification and received his reward. And Peter draws a sword and cuts off Malchus's ear. And then Jesus heals the ear of Malchus and asks Peter, "The cup which my Father hath given me, shall I not drink it?" John chapter 18, verse 11. Jesus had already conceded to do the will of his Father and to be crucified. Jesus is arrested. He is taken before Annas, the father-in-law of Caiaphas. That's in John chapter 18, verse 13. He is then bound up and taken to Caiaphas, where scribes and elders were already assembled. Now, this is a strange occurrence, but we know all of this was strange. It wasn't according to the letter of law. The scribes and elders had searched high and low to try to find a false or to find a witness, could not. So they found a false witness. At least two were found. They confirmed to themselves that Jesus had blasphemed. That sentenced him to death. They spat upon him. They blindfolded him. They mocked him. They struck him with the palm of their hands. And then we find that the disciples forsook him, and Peter denies him. He's then taken to the governor, Pontius Pilate. Now, I understand through some various sources that the distance between these places is like 2.5 miles. So each time Jesus is taken to another place, he travels by foot 2.5 miles. In front of Pontius Pilate, he is questioned and then accused by multitudes of scribes and elders, and Jesus did not answer them. So Pilate knew this was done for envy and wanted no part of it. He is then sent to Herod. That's 2.5 mile trek. Luke 23:7. Herod questions Jesus and he answers not again. The chief priests, the scribes vehemently accuse him. Herod dresses Jesus in a gorgeous robe and mocks him. He is sent back to Pilate. Pilate called these scribes together with the chief priests and rulers of the people. Pilate proclaims Jesus to be innocent of the accusations, and then Pilate sets out to release him. The crowd yells, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" Pilate tries again with the same effect. Pilate tries a third time, but the crowd in a loud voice say, "Crucify him!" Pilate yields to them and gives them Barabbas. This was a tradition that was held up for a long period of time. They would allow someone to be pardoned, and at this time Pilate did the same thing. But we know that the crowd wanted Jesus crucified, so they set Barabbas free. Jesus is then scourged and taken to the common hall. Now, scourging is a practice that's, well, some who were scourged actually didn't survive it. But I want to read a little information about scourging. It says they position a man for scourging. The soldiers try the victim frequently without clothing to an upright post in a bent position. The common method of Jewish scourging was through the use of 3 thongs of leather, the offender receiving 13 stripes on the bare breast and 13 across each shoulder, which explains the 40 stripes less one administered to Paul in 2 Corinthians 11:24. However, there was no such limit on the number of blows that the Romans could deliver during a scourging. Thus, Christ's flogging at their hands would have been much worse. Christ would have received repeated blows to his chest, back, buttocks, and legs by 2 soldiers. They were known as lictors, the severity of which depended mainly on the mood of the lictor at the time. Initial anterior blows undoubtedly would have opened up the skin and underlying subcutaneous tissue of his chest. There's a lot more information, but it gets a little bit rough. So I'm not going to read all of that. The Roman soldiers plaited a crown of thorns on his head, and a purple robe was placed on him. I know in my mind, and I'm pretty sure a lot of you have thought the same way over the years, that they actually wove together a crown of thorns and set it over his head. But let me read this article here, because it sheds a little more light upon what they probably used at that time. It says, in an act of pure sadistic torment, Roman soldiers placed an imitation crown on Christ's head and mockingly bowed down to him in reverence. But this was no ordinary crown. John 19 states, then Pilate therefore took Jesus and scourged him, and the soldiers planted a crown of thorns and put it on his head and arrayed him in a purple garment, and they came unto him and said, Hail, King of the Jews! And they struck him with their hands. Verses 1 through 3. The thorns used to form this special crown were more than a few briars. Botanists familiar with foliage in the Middle East have suggested that the thorns could have come from the lote tree. That's L-O-T-E. I'm not familiar with it. And they give the Latin name for it. Anyone interested? Okay. Starts with a Z. I took Latin, but this is a really long word. I'm not sure I could pronounce it right. This tree had thorns averaging 1 inch in length. Now imagine trying to put something together with 1 inch thorns sticking out of it with your hands. So that begs the question, did they actually do that? Did they actually take and try to form that into a circular crown to go on his head? It was improbable for anyone to form this wreath-like crown using the thorns without being injured themselves. It's more probable, therefore, that the crown of thorns was more like a helmet. In fact, it would have been easier to cut off a brush and use it as a helmet of thorns. So, something to think about. It's not definitive, but it's something to think about. When we think about the crown of thorns just being here, it's a possibility that it was all over the top of the head. So not just the scarring and the punctures in the crown and around, but on the crown as well. They took the reed and spat on him when they hit him on the head with the reed. They took the robe from him and put his own clothes on him and led him away to be crucified. The crucifixion itself, a heinous act, but Jesus was made to carry his cross. Now, when we think of that, and pictures depict a lot of times that he's carrying the whole cross. Historians claim that that's not the case. It's probably he carried the bar that his hands were nailed to. The upright was probably already placed at the site, so he was probably just carrying the bar that his hands were on. The Jewish historian Josephus aptly described the crucifixion following the siege of Jerusalem by the Romans in AD 66 through 70, because Josephus wrote these things after the death of Christ, but he is probably one of the closest historians to the time frame. So a lot of what he says we take with a little bit of concern, but yet at the same time he was close enough to the accounts and the accounts being told by people who were there. So a lot of what he says we can use as secular history. The Apostle Paul penned these beautiful words describing Christ, and being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient to the point of death, even to the death of the cross. Philippians chapter 2 and verse 8. Knowing that he had to continue on for humanity's sake, a beaten and scourged Jesus began the walk to the site of his death. Archaeological evidence strongly suggests that criminals during the time of Christ were not forced to carry an entire T-shaped cross as is commonly portrayed in Arco Deco jewelry or Hollywood films, but rather only the crossbeam known as the Pathubulum, which would have weighed between 75 to 125 pounds. It was customary, however, for convicted criminals to carry their own cross from the scourging site to the place of the crucifixion. Their hands normally were tied or even left unbound during the procession rather than being nailed to the beam. Okay. At the scourging, or just prior to the scourging, Jesus was offered a drink. I think they say that on this occasion it was wine mixed with myrrh. And then later he was offered another drink at the cross, which was wine and gall. Matthew 27, verses 33 through 34. The first one was offered, and it, assuming through historical accounts that they offered that to most of them. The pain that they went through in scourging was unbearable, and this was offered to numb the pain. The other was done in spite. He was nailed to the cross. Now we're going to get into some of the medical parts of this. Any comments or questions at this point?
Matthew 27, verse 29
sound
like they did work on that.
Yeah, but in the same vein, they can do that with the helmet too, but without having to work with the 1-inch spike sticking out of it. So it gives, that's like I said, it gives some food for thought, because they claim that that would have been very painful for somebody to have tried to wove that into a circular fashion. So more likely they cut it off is what they're claiming. So just some historical accounts going on there, secular history, not biblical history. A young girl who had a terrible fear of air raids during World War I developed the condition after a gas explosion occurred in the house next door to hers. Another report details that after being threatened by sword-bearing soldiers, a Catholic nun was so terrified that she bled from every part of her body and died of hemorrhage in the side of her assailants. While the extent of blood loss generally is minimal, hematidrosis also results in the skin becoming extremely tender and fragile, which would have made Christ's pending physical insults even more painful. So, we read the biblical account of the great drops of blood from Jesus, and we seem sometimes to think that's hard to understand. But even in World War II, we have an account here of a woman that did the same thing. So it's not an impossibility, it's actually a scientific phenomenon that has a name. I hope I pronounced that right. Hematidrosis. But it can happen in extreme situations where the blood vessels burst and blood comes forth from the skin. Aside from the mental stress that Jesus was inflicted with, his physical body was also stressed from the lack of sleep and nutrition. The Jews had beaten, mocked, and tortured him before turning him over to the Roman soldiers. The beatings administered by Roman soldiers were well known to be very bloody, leaving lacerations all over the body. Romans designed their whips to cut the flesh from their bodies of the victim. These beatings were designed to be painful to the extreme. It also caused a fluid buildup around the lungs. In addition, a crown of thorns was forced into his scalp, which was capable of severely irritating major nerves of his head, causing increasing and excruciating pain. As the hours wore on in Christ's severely stressed condition, these beatings were easily enough to kill him. His body was horribly bruised, cut, bleeding, and dehydrated. This alone would have led to shock and shock kills. I've read other accounts and information where they talked about the flogging on the back and how that these weapons that they used would just tear at the flesh. And some have suggested that it's possible that it could have looked like just one complete injury with so many strikes to the back. It could have just basically peeled the flesh off and underlying skin. So we're not talking about just some whip beatings and some stripes on his back. We're talking about severe problems. Give me a little less. Some of the accounts are that they used even metal pieces, but the leather tongs that were attached, and usually, again, this is going from historical accounts, that they had like three attached to the stick. And on the ends of that, tied into the leather, was whatever they could find that would inflict pain, cuts. So, of course, they didn't have glass like we have, plate glass. They had quartz and things of that nature. There are jagged edges that could have been used for that. And then anything metal. And of course, they had the ability to make swords and knives and anything of that sort, so they could make their own pieces, I'm sure. But yeah, it was made to tear you up. And this they weren't expecting the person to live very long anyways. And some of the accounts say they didn't. They didn't make it to the cross. But others that did, it was just an excruciating pain. Have you ever been hurt so badly that the pain just numbs, it goes away? Has anybody ever been in that situation where at some point the pain just kind of, and you feel numb? I can imagine maybe at some point that may have happened to some of those where they just had so much pain that their mind, in a defensive posture, decided to just turn loose of that pain, and they just kind of went numb. But this is not something that anyone would want to go through, I am sure. But Jesus suffered this probably, from accounts that I've read, more so than any of the others. Most of the time when they were crucifying, it was a criminal, someone who was an enemy of the state, and they were just, the Roman soldiers were just there to render punishment and get it over with. But with Jesus, it was different. It was more about humiliating him and bringing mental pain, not just physical pain, and doing it for the crowd. I don't know if they were cheering as this was going on or what, but you can imagine the scribes and the Pharisees and the priest standing back there egging the crowd on, because they were the ones that instigated this to begin with. But I'm sure the Roman soldiers were probably giving them a show. So all this was done for the benefit of the Jews that were there that day, and Jesus was the recipient of it. Any other comments or questions? Jesus was nailed to the cross, and according to Dr. Frederick Zugabe, piercing of the median nerve of the hands with a nail can cause pain so incredible that even morphine won't help. Severe, excruciating, burning pain like lightning bolts transversing the arm into the spinal cord. Rupturing the foot's plantar nerve with a nail would have a similar horrible effect. Furthermore, the position of the body on the cross is designed to make it extremely difficult to breathe. Frederick Ferrer described the intended torturous effect. For indeed, a death by crucifixion seems to include all the pain and death can have of a horrible and ghastly dizziness, cramp, thirst, starvation, sleeplessness, traumatic fever, tetanus, shame, publicity of shame, long continuance of torment, horror of anticipation, mortification of intended wounds, all intensified. Just up to the point at which they can endure at all, but all stopping just short of the point which would give the sufferer the relief of unconsciousness. One doctor has called it a symphony of pain produced by every movement, with every breath, even a slight breeze on his skin, could bring screaming pain at this point. Medical examiner Dr. Frederick Zugaby believes Christ died from shock due to loss of blood and fluid, plus traumatic shock from his injuries, plus cardiogenic shock causing Christ's heart to fail. James Thompson believed that Jesus did not die from exhaustion, the beatings, or 3 hours of crucifixion, but that he died from agony of mind producing rupture of the heart, which his evidence comes from what happened when the Roman soldiers pierced his side. The spear released a sudden flow of blood and water, John chapter 19, verse 34. Not only does this prove that Jesus was already dead when pierced, but Thompson believes it is also evidence of cardiac rupture. Respected psychologist Samuel Houghton believed that only the combination of crucifixion and rupture of the heart could produce this result. There's no question that the act itself was more painful to him than words can describe. Biblically, it is clear that Jesus chose and willed his moment of death. That moment was induced not by pain, emotional stress, heart attack, or any other, but by his own will. Though fully human, he was also fully divine, as God could not die from external sources, but only of his own volition and will. I can't imagine, and I've tried to read this through and to give you an idea in your mind, because we have no photographs of it, we have no videos of it, we have just the Word of God. Words passed down through secular history of people that had witnessed and passed along the information. And today we have a more knowledgeable understanding of the human body, so we can describe with more intenseness as to what happened at that time. But putting it all together in our mind and coming up with a picture of the event, it's still hard to do, is it not? It's just hard to imagine that anyone would go through that trouble when they were innocent. Jesus did nothing to bring this about. He was just telling people the truth, and they didn't want to hear it. Everything led to the fact that He was the Messiah, as I read early in the lesson. The information had been given through centuries before, through prophecies, and the Jews had that information readily available to them. Probably had read it several times themselves and been read to them. But they didn't make the connection. Obviously, they didn't want to. You ever tried to convince someone they're wrong when they don't want to be wrong? It's a losing game. You'll never win on that. And at this time, the Jews didn't want to believe this, that he was the Messiah. So they did everything in their power to make sure that he wasn't. Can't stop God. They couldn't stop Jesus. His death on the cross was foretold. And then by their hand and by their actions, they made it come about. But God's providence through all this, knowing that that was going to occur, and then the actual event of the crucifixion. But thank God He came to life again in 3 days. And we know that through Him that we have the hope of heaven eternal if we but do His will. So we thank God, even though this is such a horrendous event, we thank Him that it happened. But we would never want to be in that position. He did that for us. Any comments or questions? Yes. That was the crime. That was the crime that he was convicted of. Blaspheming God. It was all known. It was all known from before the earth was formed. And you bring an interesting point. Blaspheming God. My, how things have changed. Haven't they? The penalty was death. Today, you can walk down any street in America, and what do you hear? It's a shame, and it's a shame to us as a nation and a people. But that's the fact of where we're at today. People don't care to use God's name in vain and do all sorts of things against God. Any other comments or questions? I've got a whole lot more information. I brought plenty of it with me so we wouldn't run out. But I think I'll just stop right there.